This is the Barbarian Rhetoric Podcast. Acta non verba.
Welcome to another episode of Barbarian Rhetoric. Today I have my friend Doug with me. We're both a couple of old school mechanics. We've been around a while. We're going to tell some stories today, hopefully be entertaining and give you another insights on what the other side sees when you take your car or truck or something to the shop. Welcome, Doug.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And you'll probably hear me call him Muggs along the way because that's how I was originally introduced to him. He drinks his coffee. He's a crazy kiltsman. So we'll go into some of that later. Let's get right into this. What got you into mechanics, and like, where'd you go to school? Did you do it in high school? What got you started, and what's been your pathway so far?
So I've always been into cars. My dad is a big, huge, you know, he grew up in the hot rod era. And so he's got pictures of me like helping him when I'm probably five or six, and he built a 1940 Chevy. Some of the really good memories of my childhood. And so, you know, I was always exposed to it. And then, like, we took that 40 Chev. So he found a 40 Chev, and then he took an old Charger, like the General Lee era Charger, and he swapped all the drivetrain and everything all into that 40 Chev. And we ended up driving that thing all the way across from, he was in West Virginia at the time, and we drove in that thing all the way to California. Yeah. And so, you know, and then later on in my youth, and I was just, I don't know, I've always like, and you know, my youngest son would do the same thing, and it used to frustrate me until I figured out, oh, wait a minute, he's not much different than me. And I would always, he would always like take something apart out of pure curiosity, not out of like, you know, just being vindictive or anything. But of course, he could never put it back together. So I learned just to buy him toys from, you know, like Salvation Army or Classy Rack, whatever, you know, thrift store.
When did and you let take him have your first TV apart?
Yeah, you know, so the side thing that you know about me with video gaming and TV, like, we didn't have that in our house. Yeah. Like, I mean, we had, the TV was for Saturday
okay,
evenings.
How about radio then?
Yeah, he took computers and radios and crap apart, like that apart. Okay. Yeah, all the time. But, and so I was always modifying, like I could never leave anything stock, like my bike, right? I had an old school Schwinn with the big, huge sissy bars and the glittery rainbow seat, right? And all that. And I couldn't ever leave anything stock. So I modified that. Anything I got my hands onto, I've always modified it. And in fact, it's kind of funny when I was a high school shop teacher and I bought my Tacoma, the first thing my students said was, how long you think you can leave it stock? And I was like, oh, I think I can probably survive a year. And they're like, uh-huh. And then, no, within 3 months, I'd already blown the warranty out of it, right? Because I did re-gears and all this other stuff. And they were, of course, you know, anyway. So as far as that goes, and then when I was like, what, 16, 15 through 18, like my really good high school formative years, I didn't actually have a formal high school shop program that I went to. Just because of how my life was, but I did take welding in high school and I loved it. And, my dad and I, the first car that I ever did over 130, I mean, we rebuilt a 1978 280 ZX. Nice. Yeah. For out of two different cars. And then we built a Scirocco. We built a Celica GT. You know, so I was
having shop class at home.
Yeah, kind of, but like auto body class more than shop class, right? Because okay. this is all auto body stuff. Dad's a big auto body guy, and so, you know, and then long story, and then I had a '69 Baja Bug. That was my first car with a 1776 single port in it, and it was just, I still miss that car to this day. And so I started tinkering with it. I blew the motor up because I was tinkering with it, but I didn't have, so here's the thing. I was mechanically inclined, but I didn't have any mechanical knowledge, right? And quite frankly, even after my time in the service and So here's how I got into automotive, and this is actually a really good point to drive home. So after the service, right, I knew, you know, the whole, you're supposed to go to college and be successful. And I had no clue, first of all, because I didn't want to get out of the service. I would have loved to make a career out of it. I had no clue what I wanted to do, but at the time that I was in, I was dating a teacher, and I was like, you know, teaching would be kind of fun. She seems like she has a good time, and, you know, her coworkers are cool and all that. And so I went to community college to start my teaching degree, and any class that ended in ology, I pretty much failed. So I graduated, I left that first year, my freshman year at the community college, with a 0.9 GPA. And during that time, I had this little Honda Civic that I was doing SPL competition. So SPL is sound pressure level. So that's when stereos were like super, super huge. And so I did a whole bunch of stereo competition stuff with that. And one of my friends was like, we were just partying one night or whatever. They were like, you're always talking about cars and you're always working on cars and da, 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 da. Why don't you go check out the automotive program at the other community college? Because I was going to the liberal arts community college, right? Not the technical community college. I don't know why they got to separate them, but whatever. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I'll go check that out. And so I did. And that was in 99. And I enrolled in the automotive program, and I went from a 0.9 GPA to graduating third in my class and becoming, actually starting the automotive club that's still there. And I founded it and was president of it for like a year and a half. Because, you know, I was about halfway into my first year. And then from there, it's pretty much, it's been like that ever since. And so, like, even going into tech school, right, I still had no mechanical knowledge. Like, honestly, I didn't even know the four-stroke cycle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't even know the four-stroke cycle. Like, I didn't have the faintest idea how engine worked. I was just super curious and always fascinated with cars because I grew up around hot rods and muscle cars. And then when I was in high school, low riders, like mini trucking was the big thing. So I had about three different mini trucks in my early years.
Okay, when did you graduate high school?
I graduated high school in 1992.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Same year.
Yeah. So
I graduated the same year. So I only, let's see, because 89. No, I was working on stuff before that. 89, 88, I think, is when I started getting into engines.
So yeah.
A little bit of a decade ahead of you there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was the opportunity was never afforded me.
Horrible. Right. I had it in high school. That was mine. I had a great high school shop class, awesome teacher, Mr. Hauser. And yeah, he helped me out a lot. Learned on a good old Briggs and Stratton, started off with those.
Yeah. You know what? Those are actually really good instruction models. They're small, they're compact. You don't have to have a lot of space, especially now that, like, I know one of my instructor friends, I think he's got like 20 or 30 of them, and they're four stroke Briggs, you know, and he just has them on a shelf. And then he has the drafting class or something like that. He has them cut out the head gaskets out of some, you know, like the photography matte paper, because it's just his thing is they get past the engines, they have to, so he goes through with, you know, doing it on the table in the classroom, and then he takes it to where they have to do it independently, and the rule is it has to start. If it starts, they pass the class.
Wow, nice.
Right? So, you know, you're going through that little tiny head gasket all the time.
Yep.
So he just had the other class like
make the
little head gaskets, because it's, you know, it's a one-time deal. It's not like you got to stick it on the mower and make it like work to mow.
Right.
Yeah. So it's actually a really good, I always tried to bring that into my program, but was never able to. I couldn't get the funding for it. So.
Me. Okay. Yeah, so tech school, back to there. Let's say tech school. What happened after tech school?
Graduated after tech school, I started at a little mom and pop shop. It once was a gas station, and then it, you know, migrated into just a regular shop. It was a little tiny three bay shop, and the one dude who had been there for like 27 years by the time I started. And that was my first like actual tech experience. What I did in between during tech school, though, it was I was like the parts runner slash tear down boy for this guy that I had met when I had my Baja, and him and I just kind of hit it off. And so I hit him, I like, and then we're talking, so you can remember when I had my Baja in high school, and then I joined the military and did all this other stuff and came back, and he still remembered me. And he's like, oh yeah, man. He's like, I'll totally let you work during the summertime in between your breaks. Cause I was going to school on a GI Bill. So I would work for the VA hospital for work study. And so during the summer, I'd go work for him. And then I got my first job at that little, what was it, Siler's Automotive there in Spokane. And learned a lot from Jerry. He taught me, like, because it was foreign and domestic. Well, not European, just plain, you know, Japanese and domestic. And back then, you know, domestic, because it was still, like, late 90s or the 2000s, domestics were still, like, domestics, right?
Right.
And we had the old Snap-on brick and the CD-ROM all data. I mean, I'm sure you remember those, right?
Yes.
Back in the day, the old Snap-on brick and the CD-ROM all data. And I learned a ton from him. 9/11 hit, and the shop basically kind of went under. So I went and got a job at Nissan dealership, and it was kind of cool because that was a whole different experience. And I learned a lot from them, even though it was a bad experience as a whole, just because of who the dealership is. And it's kind of weird. I run into people that have actually worked for that dealership before, and we all say the same thing. I sold some Subaru parts to a guy off of OfferUp like 6 months ago. And come to find out, he worked at that same dealership, you know, 3 years ago. And he had the same experience I did almost 20 years ago.
Wow.
You know?
Some things don't change.
But it was cool because I got to be working for Nissan when they released the brand new 350. Okay. And how cool is it to do a PDI on a 350 that is the new, because you can remember I had that 280 ZX, and I've already been a big Nissan fan. I knew I wanted to eventually work for Nissan because I was just, I don't know, there's something about Nissan that I still admire and enjoy to this day. All my mini trucks were Nissan. And so I learned a lot as far as dealership work and flat rate and, you know, the dealership game, as they call it. And when I lost that job is when I decided, it was like, well, I'm going to go back and try to pursue my teaching degree. But this time I was like, I'm not going to teach high school or screw those stupid high school kids. They're a pain in the butt. You know, I'm going to go be a college professor and, you know, hold a few office hours and teach a few lectures and call it a day, right? Well, I have a huge affinity for history. And so I went and got a history and political science degree. And during that time, while getting my bachelor's, I was either working at I did service at a Honda dealership. I moonlighted out of my garage and actually made more money than I ever did as a regular technician. And by this time, I'd become sort of like a self-trained Subaru. And how I got into Subaru is kind of an interesting story in of itself. But so I started working on Subarus, and then started building custom Subarus for people that learned, you know, just word of mouth. And I kind of had like a quasi Subaru shop out of my house because I had a pretty decent workspace. I had like, it was probably about a 40 by 40 garage slash shop. Like, it was built in the 50s. It was brick, but it was cool because I kind of turned it into a shop space. And so I got really, you know, just good at turning wrenches between what I learned from Jerry and what I learned at the dealership, and then just being exposed to it and being on, back then forums were popular. So I was on several different car forums and I did that. And then I worked at I went and worked at an independent year. So after I got some experience, I was still going to school, how'd that work? I started working for FedEx. Yeah, that's right. So I started working for FedEx. I got that job while I was still in college. That was a really good gig. So I work at FedEx in the early mornings or the late evenings. I go to class half a day, and then I moonlight out of my garage. And this is also why I'm raising four kids.
Nice.
Yeah. So my two boys and then two stepdaughters. And so I went and sold because then 2008 hit and the economy just tanked. And where I lived, there was never much of an economy anyway. And so I sold myself. I went and sold myself at this little independent European Subaru and European shop as a Subaru tech. And they hired me and I was there for like a year. And through being there for a year, that shop was terrible. The horror stories I could tell. Oh my goodness. I met this other guy that owned an independent Honda and Acura shop. And we kind of crossed paths because he was like literally three blocks away from my house. And I did a repair on an Accord, a V6 Accord. And it came back twice with the same symptoms. And so I was just like, well, look, I don't know what I'm doing wrong. And so they're like, all right, we're just going to go send it over to Pete's independent Honda and Acura. And one day on a whim, I was like, you know what? I want to find out what I did wrong. Right. Cause I mean, I'm a perfectionist. I'm super OCD. And if you were to ever see pictures of like my toolbox or just look up on Instagram on my organizational skills, or, you know, even my work area, my buddies always used to be, this is a bit of a digression, I know. My buddies would always be like, hey, I'm going to come visit you during lunch break or whatever. And I'm like, all right, cool, come on by. And they're like, well, how do we know which bay is yours? I was like, oh, you know. And they would always reply, let me guess. It looks like Mr. Clean just got done mopping the floors and went through it, right? And I'm like, yeah, exactly. I always had the cleanest bays. You know, I'd always try to put things back to factory. If there was small little tiny stuff that I would notice, I would fix it while doing the other repairs. I'm a very thorough person and I pride myself on the quality work that I do. And my tools, there's not a single generic Harbor Freight, Craftsman, Husky, whatever
you want to say. All Craftsmen were good at one time.
At one time, yeah.
Them old enough.
Yeah.
And I have a few of those old enoughs that were made before we were born. So,
yeah. But so like, yeah, my toolbox is nothing but the big three. I went and I talked to Ken and I was like, hey, I'm the guy that messed up that Accord twice. It was a timing belt job. And for some reason, the timing belt would shred and start going through the oil pump. And then it would come back in, right? I was like, I'm just curious what it is that I did wrong. And he's like, oh, well, it looks like we can't really tell, but we're thinking, you know, da, 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 da. And of course, he fixes it first time go, no problem. Well, that started a friendship with him. And so when I decided to quit that European Subaru shop, it was Euro Subaru and Toyota, but at the end, they were just taking everything in to try to keep the doors open. I went down and hit Ken up. He's like, yeah, man, I'll take you on. So then I started working FedEx and that. And then, so this was a few years after the fact, you know, when 2008 hit. And I was like, you know, I really think I want to go back and pursue my teaching career because I still had this drive. So I went back to my old university and I was talking. I'll never forget. I was sitting there talking at the Academic Support Center in the Ed Learning Department. And I'm talking to this counselor, I guess I should say, not chick. And she's got a picture of a Harley, a Cessna 172, and a Nova. And she's standing in front of every single one of them, like three different pictures. And I'm like, oh, are those yours or your boyfriend's or what? She's like, oh, no, they're all mine. And I was like, oh, cool. And so we started that whole, you know, hey, car person, you know, mechanical, yay, fast engines. It's got wheels and an engine. I like it, right?
Yep.
And she looks right at me. She's like, so here's the deal. Here's the two choices that you're going to have to make today. You have a choice. In a look from the looking at your transcripts and records and your experience, In 9 months, I can make you career and tech ed certified and you can teach automotive. Have you ever thought about teaching automotive? And I was like, oh yeah, I'd love to go back to community college and teach automotive there. She's like, well, you may not be able to get that, but I can almost guarantee. She's like, you could probably teach high school. It's a niche market. Like it's, their jobs are kind of hard to find, but it's cool. Or what you can do, since you already have your bachelor's, is you're going to go get your master's, and it's going to take you 3 years because you're going to have to not just get your master's in education. You're also going to have to get your history endorsement. And by the way, what kind of sports do you like to coach? And I'm like, I hate sports. She's like, well, history teachers are either teaching English or coaching football, one or the other. Which one is it that you would like to do? And I'm like, well, I don't really like English either, you know? And so it was kind of like a no-brainer, right? Three more years of school and being in more in debt, or 9 months have the chance of teaching high school automotive. And so I took the nine-month route, and it was in the evening, like two times a week, the class was, and I met in the local satellite campus in town instead of driving the 45 miles or whatever it was to my university. And one of the colleagues, I guess you could call them, within that program, every year Washington has like this big, huge teacher hiring fair, and they go to the Tacoma Dome and they go to the arena where I was at. And she was like, hey, did you hear that, you know, da da da. So I was like, oh, so I paid my $25. I printed off like 40 applicant resumes. And I went through and I hit every single school, whether it was elementary or not. I mean, I even interviewed for like jobs in Alaska, right? And because I thought that'd be so, I've always wanted to go there. But anyway, and I ended up falling in on the skill center, who was looking for an automotive technician or instructor position, and interviewed and did that for like 7 years. And I forgot to mention, somewhere in there, in between semesters and stuff, I worked as a service writer for the Honda dealership. Anyway, so I became an instructor for 7 years, and then I decided to kind of hang that up for lots of different reasons. And then I've been back wrenching, and I went back to actually a shop that was on my advisory committee. Really just the best shop as far as equipment and quality of parts and work and so on. I mean, it's just, this thing is, it's a phenomenal shop. Like, it's received several awards for, like, you know, best shop in the, you know, area or Washington State. Sure. Da, da, da. So I finally learned the European stuff, because it was European Mini and Subaru. And I always wanted to learn European, because back when I was in tech school, I've always had this big kink for Beamers. And I actually applied for and got accepted into BMW school. But I didn't. I was at the same time trying to raise, back then I was just single with my two boys. And so I was trying to raise my two boys as a single dad. And I didn't want to have, I should have quit, right? I should have just done it and then relocated with them and called it a day. But I was trying to be fair and just and, you know,
all this stuff that goes with that.
Yeah, yep. All that stuff. In reality, I should have just yanked them and never let them see their mother again. But that's a different story for a different day. Mm-hmm. And so, but the BMW dealership in town wasn't hiring, and they didn't really, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I turned down that offer. And I've always told myself that I never want to own a BMW until I make enough money to pay someone to work on it.
There you go. That sounds like a good plan. Yep.
Yeah. But so then when I started working at this European Subaru Mini shop, of course, I got exposed to lots of BMWs. And guess what? I still don't want to own a BMW until I have enough money to pay someone to work on it. Because they are an absolute, oh, good. Yes. They're fun. They're fun freaking cars, but holy fuck me.
German engineering, man.
Oh, it's...
I have a engineering friend that has one down the road, and I get texts all the time. Hey, can you come help me look at this?
Yeah.
The YouTube videos only so much, and then I need some help.
Yeah, it's, I mean, anytime you're billing the customer out 20 some hours to do an oil pan, it's just like, you know, it's crazy. It's freaking nuts.
They are not made to work on at home.
No, they're not. They're barely made to work on in a professional environment.
Yeah.
They,
it'd have been nice if they had the, like, the drop engines. Four bolts, just drop the whole engine under the ground and then work on it and put it back up in there.
Yeah, you know, the Japanese are really good for that. Domestic's getting better. I know there's a lot of subframe drop stuff you do on domestics, but it's they're complex. Like
engineering marvels, when they run great. It's like owning a Jaguar. The only way you can own a Jaguar is if you own two. No, you have to own two Jaguars.
One in the shop and the one that's going to drive for the next 3 days.
Exactly.
Until it breaks.
And then you can flip them back out.
No, yeah. I just, you know what, though? The school got, or the school, it, you, so they do, the original owner that had that shop for 30 years, but and the one that I was in, so he's owned the business. It was a Volvo and Saab only business. Wow. And then in the, when he built his new shop, which is this one that's got the big, you know, all the awards and stuff, he turned it from, it became Volvo's, so it was Volvo, Saab, Mini, and Subaru.
Okay.
And then the new owners took over 2 years ago, and they made it all European, Mini and Subaru. And, you know, I've always kind of liked Volvos. I've never been exposed to them. But having now worked on them for the past year plus, you know, those are really good cars. As far as a European car goes, if I was to buy a European car, somebody says, hey, I want to buy a European car, I would totally recommend a Volvo. They're actually really good cars. They're not bad to work on.
Yeah, not but aren't they overall ugly?
You know, some of them,
Volvos.
Some of them are. Well, see, I've always kind of liked the older ones, like the old 240s and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. There's some really super sexy Volvos, especially the R series. Those things are just freaking rockets. And, you know, the other thing I'd say, difference between, like, European cars and any other car, you know, here's what's good about European cars, outside of the fact that they're way over-engineered, and then the German ones are overthought, over-engineered, and then they overthink the over-engineering and re-over-engineered again.
Yep, that sounds about right.
Is they ride so nice. If I had a choice between taking a road trip in a Volvo S70, let's say, and a Subaru Outback or a Honda Accord, or hell, I don't know, like even a GM. Does GM make anything good anymore? Which is a terrible thing for me to say since I'm a Chevy guy, besides their trucks.
I can't think of a GM car. I can't really think of anything since the 80s.
Anyway, a GM, do they still make the Impala?
Yeah.
The modern day Impala, right? Anyway.
Yeah, I think so.
I would totally take a European. I would totally take a Volvo. They ride so nice. The Europeans, the thing is, they ride nice. They're quieter. They're more luxurious. Blah, blah, blah. The problem is, you get to own it for about 3 years, and then it's nickel and diming you. Right, versus the other cars. My dad's old 2003 GMC Sierra truck's got 370,000 miles on it, and he's still driving the doggone thing.
Right.
You know?
But it was built when? The 90s?
No, 2003.
Oh, 2003?
So right before they started sending everything over to China.
Okay, so one of the last few good ones.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, let's break and change gears a little bit and talk funnies. One of mine was you started later than I. I thought you'd started into mechanics earlier, so this will be a little bit off. But when was the first time you saw a rotor that was ground all the way down to the splines? I remember mine. I was 16 years old working on a girlfriend's mother's car. And I got to see my first one where it had fallen apart. It was in two pieces, and I was just seeing splines.
It was a pizza cutter?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what? I think I can actually one-up you on that. So it wasn't worn through the splines. It was worn not only through the outer layer of the rotor. It was worn through the splines and completely almost to the end. So, like, literally, it was
just down to a one disc?
it was a one disc pizza cutter. Like you could almost probably cut a pizza with it. Nice. And it was an old codger on an old Lincoln Navigator or something like that. And he's like, I don't know, it just started making noise. I'm like, dude, that's way more than just started making noise. I mean, it was so far that the piston, the caliper piston, was almost already fully extended out. Like you could just one more little pump and it would just popped out.
Popped off.
And now you're doing a full-on caliper swap as well, which I think we did anyway. But yeah, it's crazy what people do with their brakes.
Yes, I have. That was my first one. I have seen so many of those over the years. And even in getting into heavy equipment, with like your mid-range school buses and stuff, too many years with school buses. But it's amazing how far people go and be like, yeah, the noise just started.
No, your stereo just broke.
Yes.
It really happened. Or they turned it down to answer a phone call.
Uh-huh. And then you hear it.
What about the guy that calls you, right? I love this one. Oh, I just did my brakes. You know, the DIY guy that... you know, nowadays watches a YouTube video or whatever, so they're ASC YouTube certified. And, yeah, I just did my brakes, and now they're, I don't know, they're just not working right, and they make a lot of noise. I think I screwed something up, but I was trying to save a buck, which, right, why do people try to save money doing work on their own car, and then they bring you the car more effed up than it was when they started, had they just brought it to you in the first place? I mean, if you don't know what you're doing, I appreciate you trying to get on YouTube and learn. That's great that you're trying to learn something. But do it on something that's, I mean, not going to be risking the life of you and your wife and your children or whatever the case may be. I mean, brakes are kind of important. And they got the pads in backwards. How many times have you seen the pads in backwards?
Oh.
Like, how do you get those pads in backwards, buddy? So, like, the asbestos parts up against the piston and the middle parts against the rotor.
You got to use a hammer.
Well, actually, you know, with pads, you can put – I've done it 1,000 times just to see if I can do it, right? Like, how do you – you just flip them. They slip with modern-day brakes. You can actually put those pads in backwards, no problem.
Did you miss most of the drum brakes?
Yes, fortunately.
Okay, so you didn't get to experience all the fun stuff of people putting drum brakes in incorrectly.
A little bit when I was working for that mom and pop shop. Doing domestic, yeah.
See, that's where I would catch people. GM
truck brakes and stuff, yeah. Doing all the brake springs wrong and stuff.
Yeah, that was a given. Drum brakes and people just don't get along. Yeah. And the nice part now, though, is you have YouTube or you have your phone to take pictures.
Yeah.
That was the biggest problem, is they take everything off both sides and then have nothing to compare to.
Yeah. Now, big drum brakes are hell of a lot easier than small drum brakes.
Amen.
I'll never forget my first drum brake job on because there's still cars out there that come with drum brakes, you know, like the lower end, you know, whatever cars. I'll never forget my first drum brake job on, it was like a little Honda Accord. Dude, that freaking thing, because, you know, you got the hub and then you've got all the stuff that's like literally behind the hub. So you got to work behind that hub, or you pull the hub out and do it and put the hub back in. But then we're talking a bearing pull and you screw that all up, blah, blah, blah. I think it took me like 6 hours. I kid you not. I fought that freaking thing tooth and nail, you know. But you know, once you learn it, do it a few times, it becomes easier. But yeah. Well, we used to get a lot of Russian rebuild stuff because we have a huge Ukrainian and Russian population.
Okay.
And yeah, oh my goodness, the terrible things that you can, the Russian, I mean, I don't know if you have it over there, but we literally have it when, like, people would call me and they'd be like, hey, I'm thinking about buying this car off of Craigslist. You know, this is when Craigslist was really big, mid-2000s. And, you know, I just want to know if you could look at it. And the first question I was asked, do they sound like they have an Eastern Bloc accent? Yeah. I was like, don't buy the car. You know, because they buy these, they'll find a wrecked car at an auction. And, of course, they just jerry-rig it together with Bondo and newspaper or whatever they can. Or they, a coworker wrecked their car and they'll barter a deal. Hey, I'll buy the car off you. Don't turn the title in. So then they get to sell it as a clean title.
Right.
And the car's just effed. And I remember one time I actually had an acquaintance of mine ask me to come over and look at this guy's Subaru, and I didn't know. And again, I pull up into his house, and sure as shit, it's a Russian rebuild outfit, right? He's just a bunch of freaking Yuri, What you do? You drunk? Go home. You know, and he's got the entire ABS module cut, like all the wires going into the ABS module.
Well, that turns the light off.
No, they couldn't, because it was so mangled. They couldn't, like, something was damaged, and instead of just like re-looming it or pulling the frame properly, they just let it hang, and they cut all the wires off of the original bus connector. And everything was with those stupid generic butt splices. Not even the quality heat shrink ones, right?
Right.
Everything was butt spliced together, and they wanted to know what was wrong with their ABS. And I looked down at that, and I was just like, you're kidding me, right? I was like, yeah, well, we made sure all the colors matched. I was like, okay, that's fine. But did you – I was like, if your colors match in a 2003 Subaru, they may not be the same on a 2004. And I said, second of all, with every single one of those butt splices, that's resistance. You're creating too much resistance for that computer. I mean, computers are – if it's a half a volt out of – you're like a map sensor, right? If it's a half a volt out of range, I mean, a half a volt, 0.5 volt, and the computer's going to go, oh, my God, you know. So I just – oh, my goodness. But, yeah. So that was a terrible, like, break experience. I've had them where they've – remember the stupid orange goopy crap for the – to keep it from squealing you put on the back?
Oh, yes.
It turned into, like, this weird glue.
And what was funny was that was always on the do-it-yourselfers.
Yeah.
The do-it-yourself – you knew who put their own brakes on.
Yeah.
Because the shops all just threw the stuff away.
Right. But that orange goopy stuff, that stop squeak or whatever it is, and it turns into – I mean, brake grease is fine, right? I mean,
right.
Synthetic brake grease for the slide pins and all that.
But that goop stuff was – just...
So this dude coated the pad part, so the material, in that goopy stuff. And then his car was, like, pretty much was locked up. Like, every time you hit the brakes, it almost throw you out the windshield. You know, I don't understand why I can't brake. I'm like, well – you glued your pads to your rotors, dude. You know? It's, oh, gosh. We could probably go on for days about different horror stories. How about okay, how about the worst? How about – so I got this a lot at when I was at the – when I was doing service. Some of the junkiest cars you've had to work on. Like, for instance, the hoarder car where it's just the seat is free.
If the seat is free. I've been in them where the seat was, like, form-fitted.
Yeah.
With garbage and stuff and odds and ends. You can't throw anything away. Yeah.
And I would tell the customer, I was like, I'm not having my technicians work on that car. You need to clean the car first, and then we'll work on it.
But then they look at you puzzled because in their eyes it's clean because, you know, it's not garbage.
But yeah, we had this one – a couple.
How many times have you got the dead fish?
I've never got a dead fish.
You never got the dead fish? Like the guys going down, they were fishing at the lake and stuff, and they came in and one of the little guys got dropped under the seat and they brought it in?
No.
Ever had that? You have lucked out, man.
I've gotten plenty of dead mice.
Dead mice, yeah.
Or one time this they were actually really good customers. Hippies from hell. Like they had all the little trinkets and trinkets and figurines all over their dash. They had a little Honda Element, right? And they traveled with a cat, like straight up cat box in the back, curtains on the windows and shit. And that cat would stay inside the car while you worked on it. It would go up and down the hoist with you and everything. It was just like, but you're working on this car. It smells like a freaking cat box, you know, or the smoker. Yeah.
You know, all the campers I worked on, the different people with pets.
Yeah. The smokers that smoke with their windows up.
Yes.
Oh, goodness. Those cars are the worst.
You got
ash everywhere.
Yeah. Deadly. Yeah.
Did you ever have to do a blow and go? On customers' cars?
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're going to have to do blow and go on my car to get it started here. You know, I'll put it in bypass mode for you and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, I ain't freaking blowing on that thing to start your car, man. What the hell? You better give me a freaking new mouthpiece or something. But yeah, I've had to do that several times on customers that are on the blow and go.
That's hilarious. No, I was out of the system of cars before. That's why I went heavy equipment. So I have more heavy equipment, farm equipment, and then into school buses more so. And I got to avoid all that crazy crap. Now, here's one for you on the flip.
Diesel's where it's at, though. I wish I would have gone into diesel.
Yes and no. Body work is where it's at. The body work guys can flip cars and make stuff. That's another conversation of arguing of why not to become a mechanic in this day and age.
Yeah, no doubt.
But how often or have you ever knocked yourself out? Pry bar, working underneath something, pry bar slip, wrench slip. Have you consciously knocked yourself out?
I have never knocked myself out, but I sure have given myself a ringer, like, you know, popping some ball joints or something free, you know?
Yeah.
But so back in the day before headlamps were a thing, because now I just wear a headlamp and it's great, and, you know, different little shop lights and stuff are really changed things. But I used to always have one of them little stream light pen lights in my mouth, right? And that's how I worked. And that's in fact, when I close my mouth, you can see a perfectly rounded, worn hole in the front of my tooth, in the front of my teeth. You know, my dentist's like, what the hell is that? I was like, oh, that's from holding a flashlight for 15 years. I smacked it on something and it just freaking, it hurt. Like, I mean, I was like, holy crap. I mean, I think it even chipped a little bit of enamel off. Fast forward a year later, I was getting a root canal and the dentist is like, yeah, you had a hard impact on that tooth and you killed it. And so it's completely dead. So I have a $6,000 fake tooth as a result of a flashlight.
See, my knockout, my one good knockout, I was working on a combine and I was up inside of it and I was changing out the grates. And my pry bar slipped. And when that slipped, I slammed back and hit my head on the back because I was all the way up in there. Yeah, the farmer woke me up when he came home.
Dang, dude.
That was a fun one. He's like, how long you been knocked out? I'm like, I don't know. And I was like 18 at the time. I slammed myself hard.
How many times you turn around and smack yourself on the hoist arms? Like a straight up freaking ringer, man. Oh, gosh.
Somewhere along the line, I'm going to say my early 30s, I quit hitting my head. For the sheer pleasure of, I just slowed down.
Yeah.
You know, 90% of the injuries that people have working on their vehicles is because they're in a hurry.
True.
And I got to the point where it's like, hey, I'm going to take my time, and I still have all my fingers and toes. And unless a lot of mechanics can't say that.
Unless you're a clumsy dude like me. I'm just inherently clumsy.
Sorry, do you wear a bump cap then to protect yourself? Are you one of those guys?
Hell no, dude. No. I just grin and bear it. Yeah, I still smack my head to this day. Okay. I'll forget.
It's not like you're short.
Well, yeah, there is that, right? I wish they made hoists for people like me.
You know, there is nothing, especially like a ramp style hoist. It's like going up and then it stops. And you're like, I just need a little bit more. Or you want to lower it down and sit on a creeper seat.
Yeah.
And there's no halfway in between. It's like, It's like three quarters of the way type thing.
Yep. Oh. What else?
I'm trying to think. I had one more because I was wondering if you knocked out the grader. Oh, how often have you gotten your customers that have come in and asked for the blinker fluid to be changed?
Never, but at the same time.
Never have, out there in all the craziness?
No, I have other crazy stories, but yeah, never like.
Straight up, someone just fooling, like parents messing with kids and stuff and having that come in.
No.
My first experience was actually in tech school. I was working for a Sears shop when they still had an automotive.
Yeah, I remember the good old Sears shops.
Yeah, before all the hoopla. Well, actually, it was during all the hoopla of Sears. But once a week, we would have a customer coming in, and it was like a running joke. And the service writers would put it down. they'd actually write down their blinker fluid, and they'd put like a little box next to it for me to check off. And one day, about the fourth time, I'm like, this is a freaking joke. Da-da-da. And they're like, oh, shh. One of the service writers took me off to the break room where there are no customers. And they're like, yeah, we know this. And this is the shady stuff back in the 90s that Sears was doing. They're like, yeah, we have these customers convinced that they have to get their blinker fluid changed. And they charge like $9.99 for it or something.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's... I'm like...
terrible.
You're like, they're like, yeah, if they ask for it, we just write it down. Just check the box. Don't say nothing. And I'm like, I can't do this. This is full on. And they're like, it makes them happy, makes them feel better. That's and back ridiculous. Then, being an 18-year-old kid, not knowing stuff better, you know, it didn't take me long to realize how unlegit that was. And that was the whole time when out there in California, they were really ripping people off for doing all kinds of bad things.
Oh, but, yeah.
But, yeah, we actually had service writers putting that down.
I'll be right back. I got to check something real fast. Is that be okay?
Hold on.
Oh, you mean like it won't be able to?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll splice it together and mess with it. Technical difficulties on the operator error side. So we're back at it.
Well, if not, then hey, that was the trial run. Now we can actually do the real thing, right?
There, exactly.
What was the most jerry-rigged car you've ever had? Like, you were like, how the hell did this thing even get into the shop?
Carney vehicles. Carney trucks, Carney mobile homes. I don't know how those things stay going down the road. I honestly would see
meth heads are great at jerry-rigging stuff.
Yeah. See, I've installed that. Being in the truck shops and stuff, but those, especially when during fair time, they would come through, and I saw a lot of them. I saw plenty of them that either had front brakes only or rear brakes only, because you know you can only afford one or the other.
Yeah.
We had one that came in. At some point, their rear axle fell out from underneath because the spring bolts broke. And it was wired back in. Just baling wire. Set on the frame. Goodness. Tied around. And they asked us to fix it better. Not correctly. They asked to fix it better. But they came in with the axle baling wired to the frame.
Oh my goodness.
On speaking, not the Dodge Dart. What was that little Dodge camper that they had there for a while? I want to say a Datsun. It looked like a little flat mini Datsun type thing, not Dodge, but it was like this little camper body, small.
Well, the Toyota trucks had like these little the dolphins. They had like it was a Toyota. Was truck with a camper shell, like a motorhome on the back of it. Yeah, it was just like the cab, and then
okay, it might have been a Toyota, but yeah, think a quarter ton truck with a camper shell on it, and that's what this thing was.
Yeah. So.
And that was probably the most jerry-rigged vehicle, but I got used to all that stuff working on farm equipment. Because farmers, they just make things work.
And that's right.
There was between doing that, working on heavy equipment. I mean, I worked in a quarry for a while and different places along that lines, and you made things work. You know, right. You didn't have access to tools, or you didn't have access to parts, or the big one was the cost factor of a part. It's like, you need to make this work. So jerry rigging was just part of life for the longest time. I mean, it really, until I got into school buses for several years, and even then, that was still late 90s, early 2000, we were still make things work. It wasn't until like late 2000s that you went from there to, oh, okay, turn it back to factory.
Right. So,
mind shift change.
Yeah, I think the worst jerry-rigged car I've ever seen was this car came in from another shop, right? It's amazing at some of the shoddy work that some shops do, which is why I think technicians get such a bad rap. And it sucks because it seems like all the dishonest, shoddy shops are the ones that do well and stay in business and make a crap ton of money. And then the honest, ethical ones are always struggling.
Right.
But so this car came in from a different shop, had its clutch done, but it was still wasn't working right. And so I get it up in the air. And, you know, yeah, sure enough, it's like, you know, it's not engaging and there's something wrong with the clutch. You know, just whatever. Get in the air, start doing an inspection. And it seemed like every time I turned around, I discovered something new. So evidently they didn't have the right tool to take the axle nut off, right? So this is on a front wheel drive car. So they straight up, like, it looks like they tried to, because there was a whole bunch of air chisel marks.
So they got her done.
So they air chiseled it off, but then they stripped out the CV axle ends. So then they just put a CV axle nut back on the CV axle. And you know how, like, axe heads, you put or a hammer, you'll put a little nail in just to kind of swell the wood and make it hold.
Right.
They did the same thing, but used drywall screws.
Wow.
Like, they straight up drilled and tapped. Or no, it was like regular bolts. They drilled and tapped holes.
Hey, they put some effort
into the side, and so they put a bolt in it, but of course it wasn't holding. Every single subframe bolt was loose and or stripped or missing. So it was hanging in barely, like barely. There was... like, and mind you, this is a brand new clutch. I could see clutch fibers all along the bell housing, like just shredded, like the clutch blew up somehow. The shift linkage was like cobbled together with cotter pins and mechanics wire. The ball joints. Oh. The ball joints were completely hogged out, and they had just like kind of tried to. I actually think they welded one in. They like straight up welded the ball joint in because it was just all hogged out. So they just welded it.
Nice. It's not gonna fall apart.
Yeah. The tie rods were completely stripped out as well, and they just had like. A wrong fitting bolt on it so that it would cross thread it and kind of hold it into place. You know, I mean, this car was like the strut assembly. Cause in order to do this clutch, you got to do a subframe drop. Right. So the strut assembly was like the top of it, like where it goes up into the, you know, in the strut towers. Well, they couldn't figure out how to, they must not, because sometimes struts are directional. You have to get that top bearing plate in the correct way, even though it's on a pivot. Yep. Well, they couldn't, you know, obviously they're like, they got it backwards or they put wrong, left on the right or right on that. So all they did was just drill new holes, you know, with like maybe a eighth of metal between it and the old original OEM hole,
you know?
It was literally, we were like, I don't understand how this car even made. Well, it came in on a hook, but
so
we
it didn't
were,
get far.
No,
which
it didn't
is probably
get far.
A good thing.
And then, of course, the customer. I mean, it would have cost probably twice the value of the car to actually make it right. And that's if we could make it right. Because you think about it, full subframe drop.
Yep.
Redo all the stripped out holes. You either have to retap them or cut the old original frame nuts out, weld in new frame nuts. I mean, the customer finally was like, "Yeah, no." Because I think it was going to be like a $6,000 ticket, at least. Or how about the customer that's like, "Well, I don't know how that happened." You know, this dude brought me an Xterra one time when I was at the Nissan dealership.
That's a wonderful comment. I don't
with
know.
This, yeah, with this, you could see the struts, like where they hit the hood. You could see the three bolt dimples. And nice. He has no idea how the struts on his 3-year-old Xterra ripped through the strut towers and then hit the hood, and he didn't know what was wrong. And I'm like, "Really? So you were not like off-roading and jumping the thing at all, right? This is a warranty issue, right?" this is manufactured defects. Like, I don't know what happened. I was just driving and it happened. And I'm like, all right.
Yes.
AKA you were drunk with your buddies and you're like, hold my beer and watch this.
One of my favorites was parking brakes on big trucks.
Yeah.
Because it's a transmission brake. Well, oh, people okay. would forget to go. And if they just start hitting gears on a nice low range transmission, you'll go. You'll push right past through that brake. It heats up and burns it all out. And you'd look at guys and be like, did you not smell something? And they'd be like, no. Did you feel like you were driving slow? No, not really. You just noticed it when you put the parking brake on that it was already down? Well, yeah, so something must be wrong. Yeah, because you never took the parking brake off. No, I did. No, you couldn't have, you know, and that was a common thing. It's just, they would, yes.
What about the customers, like, ever since you fixed the radiator, my radio doesn't work. I mean, that type of scenario.
Oh, those are wonderful.
Right? All the time.
That's one reason why I don't do homework anymore.
Well, it has nothing to do, I mean, this is... Even at the shops.
I know. But with the shop, you got someone else to tell them to screw off. Yeah, home, you have to do it yourself. So.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, and here's the thing with the customers, you know, for those that are listening that take their cars to shops, it's not that it's the symptoms broke. I mean, we'll just go with the whole ever since you fixed my radio or ever since you fixed my radiator, my radio doesn't work. It's just that what they do is the minute you touch their car, they have a new heightened sense, right? So they become numb to the car and all the stuff that's going on with it. And then when it gets touched, they all of a sudden start paying attention. And they realize all this other stuff doesn't work. Well, it didn't work in the first place.
Right.
You know, it's just, but for some reason, because you're the last person that touched it, it's your fault.
Yes.
You know, which is why inspections are so important. I mean, we do an inspection on every single vehicle that comes in. These are all the things that you're wrong with your car, you know? And of course, customers are like, well, you're just trying to get money from us. Well, no, these are the items that we noticed that are wrong with your vehicle when it was in our shop. Here's what we recommend you address. Here's what can wait. Get to this when you can. You know, it's not that we're trying to make money. I mean, yes, we are, but at the same time, we have your best interest in mind. Provided it's an ethical shop and not trying to sell you big blinker fluid, right? But it's like, you know, of course, according to the customer and the way they see it, is we're just trying to rip them off and get more money out of them. You know, well, my brakes work fine. You're right. They do work fine. They're also down to 2 mils. So they're not going to be working fine 3 months from now or a month from now, depending on what your driving habits are, you know, or... Well, my car shifts just fine. Yes, we understand that, but your transmission fluid also happens to look like gear oil, like burnt oil, like it looks like diesel oil, right? So that's the frustrating part, I think, for me. It's like you do all these repairs, you spend all this time, or you do this inspection, spend all this time doing a write-up, and then the customer's like, oh, and the worst is, okay, thanks, I'll get back to you, or I'll let you know, or, oh, no, I'm not going to do it yet. And then the customer comes back, you know, 3-4 months later to get their oil changed once again, or that was making some other weird noise. And you notice that all the work that you've recommended has been done. And you can tell it was done either by Shade Tree Joe, their buddy, or they took it to some other shop that was going to be less expensive. And the reason why the other shop was less expensive is because they used inferior parts.
Right.
And it's even more frustrating when they bring it back for the same symptoms that they brought it to you for. And you look at it, and it's got, like, you know, eBay parts on it, you know. Instead of buying the quality, let's say, strut or quality brakes, they've got the $20 brake pad with the $30 rotor on there.
Yep.
You know, and it's doing the same symptom. And it's like, yeah, so you're not saving any money because now you're back in here, and now we're going to stick on these parts, which are – high-end OEM factory quality parts and or better, and it's going to cost you more than what it would originally cost you because you've paid for it twice now. Once the cheap route and once the quality route.
Yep.
You know, it's just, I really wish people would understand that just let us fix your car. Right. Just let us fix it right the first time. You know, the shop that I was at until I recently changed jobs, they have a 2-year warranty on all their parts and labor. Well, on their parts. Right. Sometimes it's a part failure. So, you know, the warrant, but yeah, they back their repairs by for 2 years. You know, so if you're going to back your service by a 2-year warranty, obviously you're going to be buying more really quality parts.
Right.
Which means, yes, the price is going to be more expensive. That's, yes, our brake jobs are more expensive than Les Schwab. Or, yes, you know, whatever the case may be, this head gasket job is more expensive than the dealership or really close to it. Well, so-and-so down the road can do it for this much. And usually at that time, it's like, all right, well, go take it to them then. You know, but it's frustrating as the technician because customers have no idea what it takes to be a tech. Right.
Not anymore. There's several reasons to this. One, nobody works on cars much anymore.
Right.
Because unless they're so working complex on customs or hot rods, but they don't know, you know, even in the 90s, it was getting to be less and less.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of going on, but really coming out of the 80s, I used to walk around the neighborhood and I'd see people working on cars. By the time the 90s rolled around, you hardly saw anyone working on their cars.
Yeah, well, nowadays, you know, and then with the manufacturers putting all those plastic cutters on there, you can't get to the engine anyway, right? They don't want the customer touching the car, and rightfully so, because it's way different from an 88 or an 85 Honda Civic, let's say, to a 2000 or a 2020 Honda Civic, right? I wouldn't want the customer to work on their 88 Honda Civic working on the 2020 if they had no experience in between.
This is true.
You know,
it's because they become computerized, they become rolling computers.
We're making smarter cars for dumber people.
Exactly.
You know, I myself have to catch myself because, you know, my truck has got blind spot monitoring and lane correction and all this stuff and a backup camera. And, you know, back in the day when you and I learned how to drive, right, you look over your shoulder to check the lane to make sure there's no car there, or when you're backing up, you actually turn around, you know, and look behind you.
And now it doesn't work.
And now, dude, sometimes I'll catch myself, like, I just turn my blinker on, and if my little light doesn't flash, I just get in the lane. Yes, I'm safe because it knew that nobody was there, but at the same time, it's like, oh, crap, you know, I forgot to look.
But now here's something a lot of people don't realize is there's built-in blind spots on cars now. Where a lot of the older cars, they kept it all open, you know, especially the sporty ones with your hood higher than your freaking mirror. You can't even see the back, you know, what's directly behind you. You have to have all these sensors working because you can't see all the blind spots. And that's one thing that drives me batty. You got these small little teeny mirrors on cars with poor visibility to begin with, and now we rely on sensors and hope they work.
Correct, which is, I mean, more stuff we got to figure out. Or, like, you know, sometimes it will take me all day to diag something because I'm having, so, you know, let's just say something as simple as your automatic lift gate, right? What the customer doesn't understand is there's three different control modules. There's a body control module, an engine control module, and then there's usually a module in between that communicates all of it, right? Hey, if that's for me, tell them I'm busy.
I will.
Okay. And so the lift gate randomly opens up while going down the road, right? Or it doesn't open at all, or whatever the case may be. They don't understand that I actually have to break out, you know, because it was like, oh, you just hook up the computer and it tells you what's wrong with it. No, not necessarily. What happens if your car's not running right and there's no check engine light?
Right.
You know, then you have to start doing this whole diagnostic procedure. Yes, using computers or picoscopes, which are super cool, but you have to have lots and lots and lots of education.
That's on your end.
I don't even know who this person is. you know, lots and lots of education, to even know how to function. Like, in order to go, in order to operate a Picoscope, because that's kind of like the latest thing that has come out as far as diagnostics go, dude, it's an easy, like, just your basic intro course to understanding Picoscope is a weekend long training, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and you do this like every other 3 or 4 months, you know, and it's Picoscopes. I mean, it can monitor, you can monitor voltage, you can monitor air pressure, you can do this. Like, they're really cool. They're super phenomenal. But you're going to remember, I might spend 6 hours diagnosing a car, and they're probably going to get billed about half that. I mean, obviously, you get about an hour, hour and a half for diag time. If you're going to run into more, obviously, the service writer is trying to sell more or needs to sell more, especially these complex electrical systems. I mean, but I've watched, like, the top diag tech try to figure out what's wrong with a Porsche Cayman, and he's been on it for 3 days, and he's got stuff just all opened up on it, right? And it's been all electrical testing, you know? Well, and it's because you've got over 100 computers in that damn thing.
And the challenge that I have seen with, like, a lot of new guys coming in, and if you are, and if you know of someone, or your kid is thinking, or whatever else, with becoming a tech, is troubleshooting is at the end of the vid when you're learning. And a lot of guys go to tech school and everything, and they learn the newest, latest, greatest troubleshooting stuff, and then they go out and their first job is oil changes.
Right.
And they're in the depressed. You know, it's like, but there's a two-way balancing here. One, you got to know how to an engine works.
Yeah. And
the young guys come out, they may have some of the most awesome troubleshooting skills and tell me how this freaking new scanner works and everything. And then I'd walk over and I go, does your scanner really matter though, if this wire's unplugged? And I'd plug, you know, something simple into, like, you know, just a sensor or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people that don't understand you have to have both knowledge. You got to know how the inside of your engine works. You got to know how the brakes work. And if you know how all that works, then you turn around and you go to the troubleshooting side of things. And then you get to play with all the fancy toys and scanners and everything else to tell you what the computers are trying to. But it always amazed me when I was training people, especially coming up with the computers and as it evolved over the years, of how many guys are going, yeah, the computer is saying this. And I'm like, okay, but I can't figure it out. Well, did you look at the area that it's a problem in? And they're like, well, what do you mean? Did you go check connections? Or even simpler, did you check a fuse?
Right. Or, like, you know, I mean, prime example would be, like, you know, Joe Snuffy goes to Auto Parts X, and because their check engine light's on, and it says, oh, oxygen sensor. Yeah, it says that's because that's what the code's for, right? So then they bring it to you. It's like, oh, my oxygen sensor's back. Can you replace it for me? And we're like, no, we're going to do a full diagnostic on it. Well, the code reader, the scanner, they always call it a scanner, which it's not. It's a code reader. It doesn't scan anything. You can't do any live data. You can't do any testing with it. It just read what was the computer was saying is wrong with the car. So this is the O2 sensor. Well, there's so many factors in what can make an O2, what makes that computer say that the O2 sensor is bad, right? Car could be running rich, so the O2 sensor is constantly trying to drive it lean, and it can't. So the computer's like, it's always on constant lean voltage. So, and I'm still getting this much, you know, fuel coming out. O2 sensor must be bad, you know, or, you know, it's like, or it's misfiring, whatever the case may be. There's so many factors related to an O2 sensor, which is, like, probably one of the more simpler circuits within a car. It may not just be the O2 sensor. You could have a vacuum leak. You could have an intake manifold leak. You could have bad plugs. You could have bad injectors. I mean, there's just so many variables that come into play. So even though the code reader says it's an O2 sensor, it may not be an O2 sensor. You know, sure, okay, test the O2 sensor, see if it's switching, see if it's a heated O2 sensor, is the heater turning on or off. Yeah, I mean, sure, you test that first, but if your tests pass the O2, I mean, if the O2 sensor passed the test that you do on it, well, then what? Now you got to figure out what's making that the O2 mugs. Sensor well, tell the computer that it's bad. All you got to
do is buy the little $12.99 deal that plugs in, and then you get the app for your phone, and it tells you everything that's wrong, and then you just start changing parts.
Yeah, and then we can go get a mechanic in a can and fix our car, right? head gasket repair. So. Stop leak.
Either that or you're better off to just purchase something like what, pre-1990?
No, I would say anything 2000 and older is fine, because like I actually really like I like OBD2, so I like 96 to about mid-2000s, like 2005. At least for me, after 2005, things have gotten really, really complex. You know, that being said, my 2019 Tacoma, like, I feel like I could work on it. Right. You know, the engine's not so crammed in there. It's still a pretty straightforward motor. It still looks like a old school V-style motor. Sure, there's all these stupid sensors and crap in it, but not to the point where like you're scratching your head. But yeah, I would say 2005 and older.
Older.
You're getting into cars that were still good. They're still reliable. They're not overly complex. They're, you know, emissions compliant. They last a long time. They didn't have all the stupid features that you have to try to figure out. I mean, do you really need an automatic lift gate and blind spot monitors and air conditioned steering wheel and all this bullshit? You know, it's like, holy crap.
Some people believe they do.
I guess, you know,
here's something.
Getting way more comfortable, and it's kind of weird how cars have evolved. And it's actually a result of women. Men didn't give a shit if they had to get out and crank their car with a hand crank. But then when the motor companies figured, hey, if we can get their wives to drive, we can sell more cars. All right, let's put in an automatic starter. You know, and that's how it all, that's where it took off.
Let's finish this up with this. If guys were looking to get into turning wrenches, especially younger guys, what would you would say the path of least resistance or the best path to follow? Go through tech school, go through like community college, start working at your local shop, on the job training. What do you think would be the most economical way to get into turning wrenches in this day and age?
So all three of those paths are okay. Here's what the difference is going to be. First of all, congrats to you if you're a high school student and you're willing to go spend your summers and after school hours working at a shop. That speaks of your work ethic, right? Provided that the shop is willing to hire you, because again, we're dealing with very complex cars these days, right? So provided the shop, like the shop that I'm at now actually does have three high school boys that have been working there pretty much since they're freshmen. Some of them are getting ready to graduate. And they have a super hardcore work ethic, and they kind of do the little nilly-willy stuff. So it's going to take you longer if you do the whole start at the shop in high school and then work your way into being a full-blown, you know, let's say master ASE certified tech or whatever, or just a really solid hardcore tech. It's going to take you longer because that OJT, you're not always – you know, you don't have access to the training. I mean, sure, your boss will send you to a couple of training things here and there, but you don't have access to what is out there now because you've got to work your way into that. I mean, it's back to understanding how an engine works before you start. You know, you don't tear your computer apart to figure out why it doesn't turn on. Let's hit the power switch first, right? So that's going to take your longest route. That doesn't mean that you can't be successful at it. And I think there's still opportunities for it in some of the more rural areas. I think in your cities, those guys, those most shop owners want somebody already pretty much kind of ready to go, at least at the C level, you know, if we're going on the whole A, B, C tech scale. So then you've got your community college, which I think if you want to stay at home and, you know, it's a bit less expensive than some of these other routes. But make sure it's a good community college, right? Because when I was a teacher, there were certain community colleges that I would take my students to because I wanted them to see what a really good training program looked like. And there were certain community colleges that I would not take them to because their programs sucked. And the quality of students that I saw within those programs also sucked. So you got to do your research. And then there's the private sector, right? Which nowadays it's only UTI, Universal Technical Institute, not urinary tract infection. I think so. Lincoln. There's Lincoln.
Right.
But here's the deal. And because I'm connected fairly well with UTI. So all UTI focuses on is automotive, period. End of discussion. Anything related to automotive, whether it be auto body and automotive refinishing to machining to, you know, welding to what, but all they have focused on for over 50 some odd years or whatever it is automotive. Versus your places like I don't think WildTech's still around, but let's say WildTech and Lincoln Tech, right? First of all, they're owned by some other entity like Corinthian University or whatever, right? So within that, you've got your nursing, your little CNA program and dental assistant program and da-da-da, but then they have this side shot of, oh, this is the auto program. Well, within Lincoln Tech, then, you know, this, so they're funded by an outside entity that doesn't just focus on automotive, you know? And so you're not getting the quality instruction and you're not getting the quality tools and so on and so forth. Versus if you go to a private technical college such as UTI, you've got all that factory training backing you up. Because I've been in their establishments, I've had several of their members on my advisor committee, so on and so forth. So when you say you want to become a GM service technician, that's exactly what you're going to become because you're going to be backed by GM Corporation, who is using this school to actually teach you how to be a GM tech or a Honda tech or whatever tech, right? So and if you compare apples to apples and oranges, you know, it's more expensive than your community college, but some of the benefits far outweigh what you're going to get at community college. The question is, do you want to relocate? Do you want to get out of your parents' house? And quite frankly, you're probably going to have to take a student loan. Although I did see Mike Rowe personally write quite a few of my students' checks through his Mike Rowe Foundation to go to tech school. He'll also do the same thing for you to go to a community college as well. As long as you're going into skilled trades, the biggest resource you can tap into is Mike Rowe and the Mike Rowe Works Foundation. I don't think any path is incorrect. I think it's what fits you and where you're at and what you want to be doing. The slowest route is the whole start a high school, work your way up. The quickest route is a tech school, whether it be community college or a private tech school such as UTI. That's the quickest route to get into becoming a technician and starting your career. You'll end up at the same place at 65, right? But you're getting about a 4-year jump on the kid that didn't go to tech school. So if you graduated tech school and if you and your buddy are 18 and he stays at the local Chevron, let's say, and works in their shop, and you go to community college or whatever, when you graduate 2 years later, 18 months later, you're going to be about 4 years ahead of your buddy that just decided to stay in town and work for the Chevron. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that's the difference, I think.
All right.
So what are your thoughts?
Mine run very similar. I think the only thing that I would go different would be if you are, you know, and this goes into the branches, is if you're going into the marine industry or if you're going into the air industry, you know, things. And I'm a graduate of UTI, so I know what the program was in 92, 93.
It's changed greatly.
Yes, it has. I've looked back into it a couple of times, and yeah, it's much different than what I went through then. But yeah, I think tech school offers an advantage to speed you up through it. And I think the biggest thing that I tell guys that are getting into it is you go learn all that fun stuff with the troubleshooting and everything else, and you come out and you're going to start on oil changes and tires. And
true.
You got to suck that up and work your way through, you know, and build it up. Show initiative. Be willing to go that extra mile. Show the professionalism. And I think that's what's missing a lot of times. Just like you were talking earlier about, you know, the struts being in the wrong spots and this being done. It's just, it's a balancing act. But yeah, I personally think of mine, I think tech school, unless your dad was or you got an uncle or whatever and you grew up with it, I think the on-the-job training has become almost a thing of the past. It will get you there. But if you really want to get into turning wrenches, tech school's the way to go, or into a program. You know, if you can get accepted into one of the bigger programs, yes, that would that's another way.
Yeah, we have a community college up here, and you can get your general service technician, or they also have GM factory training, Honda factory training, Toyota factory training, Nissan factory training, Subaru, and Tesla. And this is at a community college that's about 40 miles north of me, you know. So if you want to go those routes, you're like, oh, I want to be this technician. And I would also say that would be another thing you need to decide. I think it's best in your career, if you're going to make a career out of it, pick a brand, stay with it, because you're going to learn that car, you're going to learn those systems, and you're going to be able to make good money at it. Versus if you have to work on a Ford Explorer 1 minute and you got to work on a Honda Accord the next. You know, it doesn't make you any lesser or more of a tech. It just makes you, your career path is a bit easier, and you're going to be able to make more money faster. And I think back to what you're saying with on-job training, you're not going to have those skills that you're going to be able to get like you would out of tech school, because you have to come with a certain level of skill knowledge, right?
Right.
You gotta know how to things come apart and come back together. I mean, that is learned over time. Like when you get into these really weird, how the hell am I going to get this out of here? That just comes with experience.
But you got to know the basics.
But you got to know the basics. You got to understand how a bolt comes out of something, or, you know, thread
and
pitching.
It goes back to shop class, because I was like, when I graduated high school, it was last year they had high school shop class. Yeah. So it was going away, and like you didn't have – they no longer have shop class in high school unless you're going out to the career center or something. You're not even exposed to it. And yep. We started with Briggs & Stratton engines, the most simplest, easy four-stroke engine in existence, basically. And you learn, you know, okay, you learn how everything moves around. Because really all they do is slap on a whole bunch of sensors.
At the end of the day, exactly. I mean, you think about it.
If you stripped all the sensors and everything else off, then you got to figure out how things
it's
work.
It's still pistons moving a crank that's connected to a transmission that moves a drive line that moves your tires. And it's simple as that.
And stopped with brakes.
Right. And
that's it.
That's it. But nowadays, there is about 100 computers that control all that.
All right. Let's wrap this one up. I think we've been around. Where are the best places to find you, Muggs?
Oh, geez. You know what? You could probably find me on Instagram. If you want to send me a DM on Instagram, it's the Learned Kiltzman on Instagram.
I'll have that in the show notes.
Yeah, you can email me So that would be DMCCOY. So Delta, Mike, Charlie, Charlie, Oscar, Yankee, 805@gmail.com as well for any kind of questions or inquiries.
All right.
So.
Well, good. I've enjoyed this.
Yeah. We should do it again.
Yeah. It's not often that a couple of mechanics can just talk and hear the history, you know. I think a lot of people pull in the dealership and they may only talk to the service riders or such.
Which nowadays are nothing more than salesmen.
Yeah. And they don't know the people that are working on their cars. Or if they do go to the shop, you know, how much history that's going on there or whatever. So the dynamic of customer to working on has changed over the years.
It has that. It's no longer where the techs get to see the customers, you know. So remember the old Click and Clack show? That was a great show, man. We could be the next Click and Clack.
There we go. All right. And with that, signing off for the day. Thank you. I hope you guys enjoyed listening.